corridor to the council room. Twice now I have nearly missed my step along there.
Of course, your blessedness, said Brother Mercurius, bowing to conceal his disappointment. Now it would be the other two who supported the saint on his entrance. The subdeacon slipped out of the vestry and found the eunuch waiting in the corridor, waiting for something or just standing, but in either case disconcerting. That face, a great moon of raw pastry. Brother Mercurius offered him a quick, modest smile and set about adjusting the lamps, which needed no adjusting, as he well knew. Those at the further end, close to the council chamber, were mounted a little higher than the rest, which allowed Brother Mercurius to make much of the awkwardness of dealing with them while listening for any scraps of conversation he might hear through the door. But they were cunning, these bishops and archbishops and archimandrites. 2,000 years of subtle statesmanship are not easily outfoxed by a pretty young subdeacon with a winning manner. Behind the door outside which Brother Mercurius was disingenuously lingering, three prelates from Syria were discussing raisins. Their fellow synod members, all 147 of them, were disposed around the council chamber, engaging in similarly meaningless small talk. They would not start their business until the emptying bell rang to signify that everyone but themselves had been escorted from the palace. Hearing the doors from the vestry open, Brother Mercurius turned away from the lamp he'd been fiddling with and smoothed his hands down over his slim flanks before standing modestly to one side, ready to dart forward and open the door to the great chamber. "Back, fool, back!" came a whisper in a well-known voice. The Archdeacon Falarion, who had appeared from the vestry, was the supervisor of ritual, and the office of opening the door was very firmly his. Brother Mercurius bowed and tiptoed back along the corridor, keeping so close to the wall that he was moving sideways rather than forwards. It was because he was doing that, and because he was about halfway along, that he had the best view of all of them of what happened next. The first thing was that the eunuch's goose demon from the door of the vestry honked suddenly and loudly, a great goose cry of fear and danger. Kalungian turned to see what had frightened her, and the next instant a scimitar sliced his head from his shoulders. The head tumbled with a hefty thud, and a very long second or two later, down came his body to follow it, spouting blood. His demon had already vanished. Archdeacon Falarion hurled himself at the jostling figures that were coming out of the vestry and was borne to the ground in a moment. The patriarch, supported by the two subdeacons, was too stiff to turn and look and too bewildered to speak, and the subdeacons themselves, caught between horrible fear and the desire to protect the old man, did not move either, but were both killed as they gazed back over their shoulders. They fell aside like the mould of a sculpture that has just been cast in bronze. Stiff, dead things that only serve to contain the work of art within, which is now born and visible for the first time. That work of art, the patriarch himself, stood radiant in his robes and supported still by the armature inside the cope. His expression, which Brother Mercurius could see very clearly in the radiance of the lamps, was like that of someone who has just understood the solution to a profound and complex problem, as it might be the mystery of the incarnation. But, unlike the eunuch and the subdeacons, the saint was not lucky enough to die from the first blow that struck him. His assailants, three of them, hacked and stabbed and sawed at the stiff, half-wooden figure, while his frightened demon fluttered high and fell back and careered into the wall and spun around on the floor, and drops of liquid music flew around. Saint Simeon, meanwhile, was waving his arms slowly like a beetle on its back, despite the fact that one of them had lost its hand. And presently the nightingale's song fell silent, and the old man lolled in his sustaining robes, quite unable to fall over. Brother Mercurius saw the three white-robed swordsmen, now much more vividly coloured than a few seconds previously, push the old man over to make sure he was dead. He saw them look around and behind, from where shouts and cries of anger and pursuit could now be heard, running feet, the clatter of pikes. He saw them turn their hawk faces towards him. He felt the appalling beauty of their gaze. He nearly swooned as he saw them rush towards him, and he thought of the door behind him. The door. It opened this way, and if he planted his back against it and waited to be slaughtered, it might hold the men up long enough for the palace guards to arrive. Brother Mercurius knew that within the smallest fraction of a second. He also knew that it was not in his nature to do that sort of thing, and that it was in his nature to be agreeable, to make things easy and convenient, and that this was the way God had made him, and there was no changing now. So, in that same moment, and before the assassins had come halfway down the corridor, Brother Mercurius had turned and grasped the handle and pulled the great door open. The terrified prelates inside, hearing the cries and the sounds of struggle from the corridor, had gathered like sheep in the center of the chamber, and the assassins were able to charge full at them through the open doorway and slaughter a dozen or so before the pursuing guards caught up and fell on them from behind. Brother Mercurius did not want to look at the body of the patriarch, but he knew that it would be a good thing to be discovered praying beside it. So, while the killing, the cries, the splashing, the thudding, the scraping and wailing and clashing from the council chamber filled his ears, he made his way delicately back to the tumbled structure containing what was left of the saint and fell to his knees, taking care to daub himself with as much blood as he could bear and to let the tears flow freely down his cheeks. It would be wrong to say that Mercurius was already envisaging the icons that would in time depict the martyrdom of St. Simeon Papadakis, and ensuring that an essential component of the scene, perhaps even its defining element, was the presence of the young and devoted subdeacon splashed with the martyr's blood and with his large eyes cast upwards in prayer. That is to say, that picture was indeed in his mind, but not at the forefront. He was mainly preoccupied with the enthralling questions of the succession, of the weeks of politics that would now unfold, of the possibility of promotion now that the two other subdeacons of the bathhouse had been killed. He was also intoxicated by the look in the beautiful eyes of the assassins as they rushed towards him in the corridor. He had never in all his life seen anything quite so thrilling. Meanwhile, in the main body of the great cathedral, out of earshot of the assassination of St. Simeon, the congregation, including Lyra, stood in their hundreds under the vast dome, waiting for the service proper to begin, while a choir of deep male voices sang a hymn whose length and slowness conveyed a strong impression of eternity. Part of Lyra's unobtrusiveness policy consisted of not asking any questions or starting any conversations, so she had to make do with whatever she could gather from everything that was going on around her. She absorbed the congregation's patience and trance-like stillness, intensified by the music, until a moment came when one of the singers faltered. It sounded as if he had been struck in the heart during a long-held high note. A sort of cough or gasp interrupted the line of music, succeeded by a sighing uncertainty in the other voices. After a minute or so, they seemed to gather themselves and continue, only to come to a halt after another phrase or so, although that was clearly not the end of the hymn. The choir was hidden, so no one could see what had caused the interruption. The rapt mood of the service had vanished in a second. From a single congregation, they had fractured into several hundred anxious individuals. People looked all around. They tried to peer over the heads of those in front, and after a moment came other sounds from the choir. Cries, shouts, the clash of steel on steel, and even at one point, a gunshot, which made everyone in the congregation start at once, so they looked like a field of wheat under a sudden gust of wind. People had moved at first away from the walls to gather more closely in the center of the vast building. Lyra went with them, unable to see very much, but listening hard to the hubbub and the violent struggle that was taking place beyond the iconostasis. To add to the noise, several people had begun to pray aloud in tones of desperation. Lyra turned to whisper to Pan, and of course he wasn't there, and again she felt a stab of abandonment. She gathered herself and went through her checklist, dealing one by one with the things that might make her conspicuous, so that once she was in control, she seemed only like the meekest, most passive, least determined bystander, no one worth taking an interest in. In this mask of modesty, she made her way towards the edge of the vast floor and along the wall to the doors. Several other people were already hurrying out, and Lyra could see there would be a problem if the exit got blocked. Rather than wait and be trapped inside, she slipped through the melee and shoved hard until she was outside on the marble steps, blinking in the sunlight, being forced downwards as more and more people poured through the door and spread out in front of the building. There was confusion in the public square, as rumors of assassination, massacre, bloodshed spread with the speed of fire. Lyra could only guess what was being said, but then she heard some words in English and turned to the speaker. He was a gaunt and tonsured man in a form of clerical dress, something severe and monastic, and he was speaking rapidly to a party of English men and women, mostly middle-aged or elderly, who looked fearful and sorrow-struck. A woman at the edge of the group had a kindly face that was vivid with concern, and her greenfinch demon was looking at Lyra sympathetically.
"What's happening? Does anyone know?"
Lyra said, breaking her rule. Hearing an English voice, the woman turned to her and said,
"They think he's been killed, the patriarch. No one knows for certain."
Another member of the group called out to the monk,
"What did you actually see?"
The monk laid his hand across his forehead in a gesture of desperate helplessness and raised his voice.
"I saw men with swords, dressed in white. They were killing all the clergy. His Holiness the Patriarch was the first to fall."
"Are they still in there?"
"I couldn't say. I fled. I'm ashamed to admit it. I fled instead of staying to die like the others."
Tears were falling down his cheeks. His voice was high and broken, and his mouth was trembling.
"It's important to bear witness," someone said.
"No,"
cried the monk. "I should have stayed. I was called to be a martyr, and I fled like a coward."
The woman who'd spoken to Lyra shook her head and murmured in dismay,
"No, no."
The monk's demon was a small, monkey-like creature who ran up and down his arm and rubbed her fists into her eyes, wailing in self-pity. The woman turned away, frowning, but then her demon whispered in her ear, and she looked back to look at Lyra again.
Excuse me, I can't believe that you... Am I making a mistake? Your demon?"
"No, you're right," Lyra said. "My demon's not... He's gone."
"Oh, you poor girl,"
said the woman, with genuine sympathy. This was so far from the reaction Lyra expected that she didn't know how to respond.
Are you part of this group?"
No, I just heard them speaking in English, so... "Were you inside the cathedral? Do you know what's happening?"
"No, the choir stopped singing and then... But look, someone's coming out."
In the throng at the top of the steps outside the entrance, there was a disturbance as people seemed to be pushed aside, and then came four or five soldiers in the ceremonial uniform of the patriarchal guard. They were forming a protective square around a young man in clerical dress, whose blood-stained face and large, lustrous eyes seemed, even on that sunny morning, to be lit by a spotlight. So clear was every change of expression, from sorrow and pity to patient courage, and on to a rapturous acceptance of the late saint's martyrdom. He was speaking and half-chanting words that were obviously familiar prayers, because the crowd seemed to find themselves transformed into an impromptu congregation and murmured responses whenever he paused. The woman whispered,
"I don't think I've ever seen such a shameless opportunist. He'll do well out of this terrible business."
Lyra thought so too. The little coxcomb was now appearing to feel faint and gripping the arm of the most handsome of the guards, who blushingly held him up. The priest's demon said something that drew a sigh of warm sympathy from those nearby. Lyra turned away, and so did the woman.
"Don't go," the woman said, and Lyra looked at her properly for the first time.
She saw a woman in a well-preserved middle age, with a plain, good-humoured face, whose red cheeks were not entirely due to the sun.
"I can't stay here," said Lyra,
though there was no reason why she couldn't. And since this was, from an Oakley Street point of view, where the most important events were happening, no doubt she should stay and make notes.
"Spare 5 minutes," said the woman. "Come and have some coffee with me."
"Well," Lyra said, "all right, I will. Thank you."
The sirens of an ambulance howled through the square, which was getting fuller every minute, as more people poured out of the cathedral, and still more came hurrying in from the four roads that met in front of it. Another ambulance arrived to join the first one in trying to thrust a way through the crowd. The young priest on the steps, still clinging to the guard, was now talking to three or four people who were busy scribbling into notebooks. "Reporters already," said the woman. "He's having the time of his life." She turned her back and strode vigorously through the crowd. Lyra went with her. As they left the square, they could hear a different kind of siren, coming from the first police cars that were arriving. 5 minutes later, they were sitting outside a little cafe in a side street. Lyra was glad of the woman's presence at the table with her. The woman was called Alison Weatherfield, she told Lyra, and she worked as a teacher in the English school in Aleppo. She had come to Constantinople on vacation.
"But I'm not sure how much longer the school will be able to survive," she said. "The city's holding out, but in the countryside, people are getting very nervous."
"I feel I should know what's going on," said Lyra. Why do people feel nervous now?"
"There's a lot of unrest. The awful business this morning is part of it. People are feeling brutalized by the laws, exploited by their bosses, discriminated against by social structures they've got no means of changing. It's been like that for years. There's nothing new about it. But it's a fertile soil for the Rose Panic to flourish in."
"The Rose Panic?"
"It's a new sort of fanaticism. Rose growers are being persecuted, their gardens set ablaze or ploughed over by these men from the mountains, as they're called, who say that the rose is an abomination to the authority. I hadn't realized it had spread this far."
"They're feeling the effects already in Oxford," said Lyra, and told her about the rose water problem at Jordan College. She might have regretted revealing where she came from, as it went against every principle she was trying to obey, but the sheer relief and pleasure of talking to someone sympathetic was too much to resist.
"But what are you doing traveling in this part of the world?" asked Alison Weatherfield. "Have you come here to work?"
"I'm just passing through. I'm on my way to Central Asia. Just waiting for a ferry."
"A long way to go yet, then. What are you going to do there?"
"Research for the thesis I have to write."
"Oh, what's your subject?"
"History, basically. But I wanted to see things you can't find in libraries."
"And you... the thing I noticed about you?"
"No demon."
"Yes. Is your journey about him, too?"
Lyra nodded.
"Mainly about him."
Lyra sighed and looked away.
"You're going to Madinat al-Kamar," Alison said. "Well, no need to try and hide it. I'm not shocked or surprised. I know someone else who set out to go there, but I don't know what happened to him. I tell you to be careful, but you look sensible enough to realize that yourself.
Do you know how to find it?"
"No. There are so many dead towns, dead villages in that part of the desert. You could spend years looking for the right place. You'll need to find a guide."
"It does exist, then?"
"As far as I know. I thought it was just a legend or a ghost story when I first heard about it. To be honest, I find all that sort of thing, well, I don't know, unconvincing, irrelevant, really. There's enough trouble and difficulty in this world, enough sick people to look after, enough children to teach, enough poverty and oppression to fight without worrying about the supernatural. But then I'm lucky. I'm perfectly at home in the world, and perfectly happy with my demon and the work I do. I realize that other people aren't so lucky."
"Why did your demon leave you?"
"We quarreled. I had no idea it would lead to this. I didn't think it was possible. But we didn't speak for a long time. And one day he just vanished."
"How painful for you."
"Oh, the pain."
"Yes.
But the hardest thing was just having no one to talk to. And sometimes give good advice."
"What do you think he'd say to you now?"
"About my journey, or about today?"
"Today."
"Well, he'd have mistrusted that young priest."
"Quite right."
"And he'd make me take notes about everything."
"He'd be a good journalist."
"And he'd have made friends with your demon at once. That's one of the things I miss most."
Allison's greenfinch demon was listening intently, and now he sang a few notes of sympathy. Lyra thought she should change the subject before she revealed too much.
"What about this new High Council?" she said. "What do you think that'll mean?"
"I don't think anyone knows yet. It's come rather out of the blue. I hope it won't mean that there's a much more ferocious orthodoxy. The system we've had for hundreds of years was flawed. No one claimed it was perfect, but one merit it did have was room for disagreement of a limited kind.
If there's one voice imposing one will on us all, I can't see it leading anywhere very good, I'm afraid. In the background, the noise of sirens had been continuous. Now another sound joined it, the clangor of a loud bell in a campanile nearby. A few seconds later, another bell joined in. For a moment, Lyra thought of the bells of Oxford, and felt intensely homesick, but it was only a moment. From other buildings in the area, more bells began to ring, and presently yet another sound thrust its way over them, the harsh thud, thud, thud of a gyropter. Lyra and Alison looked up, and saw first one and then two more of the aircraft circling the dome of the Holy Wisdom. "What that's likely to be," said Alison, "is the first sign of official panic. Quite soon, in fact any minute, I'd guess, there'll be police patrols demanding to see everyone's documents, and arresting anyone they don't like the look of. Such as you, my dear. If you take my advice, you'll go straight back to your hotel and stay there till your ferry goes." Lyra felt a great weariness descend on her. "Oh, Pan," she thought. She forced herself to stand up and shook the woman's hand. "Thank you for talking to me," she said. "I'll remember you." She left and went back to her hotel. On the way, she saw a police patrol in the process of arresting a young man who was fighting back fiercely. And in another street, she saw a different patrol retreating from a crowd of angry men who were tearing up the roadway and throwing cobblestones at them. She walked carefully and stayed invisible as far as she could. Even the hotel receptionist at her dingy little desk didn't notice as she walked past. Once inside her room, she locked the door. News of the assassination spread wide and quickly. Several news agencies picked up the fact that the martyred patriarch, so aged, so holy, was also the president of the new High Council of the Magisterium. In Geneva, it registered at once. The council, or those members who lived and worked in the city, and whose numbers, by the blessed workings of Providence, constituted a quorum, met at once, and opened with shocked prayers for the dead St. Simeon, whose presidency had been so short. Then they turned immediately to the matter of the succession. It was clear, in these anxious times, that the question should be resolved quickly, and it was also clear that the only possible candidate was Marcel Delamere. More than one council member saw the hand of Providence there too. So he was elected unanimously. With sorrow and reluctance, he accepted the great responsibility, proclaiming his unworthiness in phrases so perfectly turned they might almost have been composed in advance of the terrible and utterly unpredictable events in Constantinople. But even in his evident modesty and hesitation, he had the calmness of mind and clarity of vision to suggest a few slight amendments to the Constitution, all in the interests of firmness, resolution, and efficiency in, as the phrase had it, these anxious times. In order not to distract the holy work of the council with needless elections, the president's term of office was increased from 5 to 7 years, and there were to be no restrictions to the number of times an individual could serve. Furthermore, the president was to be granted executive powers, which would be needed in order to allow swift action in these anxious, etc. Thus, for the first time in 6 centuries, the magisterium had one sole leader, invested with all the authority and power that had previously run through many channels. Shorn and parcelled no longer, the might of the church now flowed through the office and the person of Marcel Delamere. And the first to feel how swiftly the new dispensation could act, and how disagreeable its actions could be, was Pierre Binot, the Chief Justice of the Consistorial Court of Discipline. He was removed from that office within an hour, and he would never interrupt anyone again. As he signed the order, Marcel Delamere thought of the sister he had admired so much. He thought of his mother, too, and looked forward to seeing her again. Chapter 23 The Smyrna Ferry. After a night in her hotel room listening to the sirens, the shouting, the breaking windows, the gyropters thudding overhead, and occasionally the gunshots, Lyra felt tired and oppressed. But the Smyrna ferry left that day, and she couldn't hide in the hotel forever. She went down for breakfast, and then stayed in her room till it was time to check out. According to the receptionist, who had read it in the morning paper, the assassins had all been killed when the guards stormed the cathedral. The rioting since had been the work of some men from the mountains, he didn't know more, exploiting the general panic. It was all over now, he told her. The civil police were in command. The hotel staff were glad to see her leave, because they were all afraid of her. She felt their alarm and dread, and since there was no point in trying to be invisible to them, she tried to dispel it by being friendly. But there was nothing she could do to acquire a demon. She felt glad to put the place behind her and make for the port. The ferry left in the late afternoon, and would arrive in Smyrna on the second morning afterwards. Lyra could have paid for a cabin, but after her temporary imprisonment in the hotel, she wanted to spend as much time as possible in the open. On the first evening, she ate by herself in the dingy restaurant, and then sat on deck, wrapped in a blanket in a comfortable wicker reclining chair, watching the lights on the shore as they went past, and the night fishing boats, and the starry sky. She was thinking about the woman, Alison Weatherfield, a teacher, a woman of clear decency and certainty, someone she would like to emulate. She reminded Lyra of Hannah Relf. The fears Alison expressed about the new High Council were like her own, though Lyra hadn't managed to think them through. Since Pan left, her focus had been entirely on her own predicament, and, no, it had begun before that, when they'd first become estranged, probably. Self-preoccupation was not something Lyra admired in others, but here she was, thinking of nothing else. Good women like Hannah and Alison found other things to fret about, or better still, didn't fret at all. Good women. It was so complicated. She remembered Malcolm describing the sisters in Godstoke Priory who had been so kind to him when he was a boy, and who'd taken in the baby Lyra and looked after her before the flood came. Clearly what they did was good, and equally clearly much of what the Magisterium did was not. But were they part of the Magisterium, because of their beliefs, or something else altogether because of their activities? She thought she'd been certain about things when she came back from the North, but the things she'd learned during her adventures there seemed so far away now. All that remained was a scatter of vivid impressions, of personalities such as Lee Scoresby and Mary Malone, and of events like the fight between the bears, and above all, of the moment when she and Will kissed in the little wood in the world of the Mulifer. She'd hugged to herself the phrase, the Republic of Heaven, but never analyzed what it might mean. When she thought about it at all, she'd thought that rationality was the very foundation stone of the Republic of Heaven. That was the Lyra who wrote essays and passed examinations. That Lyra had enjoyed disputing with scholars, and searching out the weaknesses in someone else's arguments, and cracking them open with a flourish to disclose the assumptions, the inconsistencies, the dishonesties concealed within them. That was the Lyra who had found the writing of Gottfried Brander so intoxicating, and that of Simon Talbot so disturbing. She hadn't been prepared for the revolution in her mind caused by Giorgio Brabant, and his stories of the secret commonwealth. She would once have dismissed things like that with scorn. But now, under her blanket on the deck, watching all the little points of light in the dark sky or on the dark shore, feeling the little tremor of the engines and the constant, gentle rocking as the ferry moved south over the calm sea, she wondered if she'd got everything wrong. A thought that followed naturally. Was that why Pan had left her? Time seemed to be suspended during that quiet night on the sea. She thought calmly and systematically back to the time of her first estrangement from Pan. The memories came obediently out of the dark, links on a long chain. His anger when she had been unkind to a younger girl at school, against her natural inclination and, in spite of every prompting from him, mocking her inability to distinguish between the author and the narrator in a novel set for examination. An impatient word to a servant at St. Sophia's. A scoffing refusal to go to an exhibition of paintings on religious themes by the parent of a friend. her delight in seeing so much philosophy taken apart and trampled on by Gottfried Brander. Her behaviour, and now it all came back to her, bright with shame, her behaviour towards Malcolm, when he'd been just Dr. Polstead. Small things, perhaps, but 100 of them, and they kept coming. Her demon had seen all that and disliked it, and then he'd had enough. She tried to defend herself against this self-summoned tribunal, but her defence was feeble, and she soon stopped pretending. She was profoundly ashamed. She had done wrong, and her wrongdoing was bound up somehow with a vision of the world from which the secret commonwealth was excluded. The stars wheeled slowly around the pole. The ferry moved on steadily along the coast. From time to time the lights of a village glimmered on the shore, their reflections shaken into 1,000 silver or gold flakes by the myriad movements of the water. Once or twice she saw a different kind of light, a glow from the fishing boats, each with a lantern in the prow, setting out their nets to catch bluefish or squid. They gave her another image. She was enticing monsters out of the darkness of herself. And she remembered what the dead child Roger, once her closest friend, had told her about the harpies in the world of the dead. They know every bad thing you've ever done, and they whisper about them to you all the time. She was getting a foretaste of that now. She wondered, did the harpies belong to the secret commonwealth? Was the world of the dead, the world they dwelt in, part of that? Or had she imagined it? And was her imagination just a spindrift of falsity? Well, she thought, what was the secret commonwealth anyway? It was a state of being that had no place in the world of Simon Talbot, or the different world of Gottfried Brander. It was quite invisible to everyday vision. If it existed at all, it was seen by the imagination, whatever that was, and not by logic. It included ghosts, fairies, gods and goddesses, nymphs, nightghasts, devils, jack-o'-lanterns, and other such entities. They were neither well nor ill-disposed to human beings by nature, but sometimes their purposes intersected or coincided with human ones. They had a certain power over human lives, but they could be defeated too, as the fairy of the Thames had been tricked by Malcolm when she had wanted to keep Lyra with her and not let her go. A steward came along the deck to tell those passengers still outside, there were only a handful of them, that the bar was shortly going to close. Two men got up from their deck chairs and went inside. Lyra said, "Thank you," her only phrase of Anatolian. The steward nodded and passed on. She returned to her thoughts. Did the nightghasts and fairies and jack-o'-lanterns and other citizens of the secret commonwealth exist only in her imagination? Was there a logical, rational, scientific explanation for such things? Or were they inaccessible to science, and baffling to reason? Did they exist at all? Such things included demons, surely. Well, they certainly did if Brander and Talbot were right about them. Neither of those scholars would see anything wrong with a young woman who had no demon. Alison Weatherfield, on the other hand, had seen what was different about Lyra straight away, as most people did, but, unlike most people, was warm in her sympathy. The loud man on the Channel Ferry had seen it and was warm in his hatred and fear. Demons certainly existed for most people. She couldn't get any further at that point. The sky, full of stars, seemed dead and cold. Everything in it the result of the mechanical, indifferent interactions of molecules and particles that would continue for the rest of time whether Lyra lived or died, whether human beings were conscious or unconscious. A vast, silent, empty indifference, all quite meaningless. Reason had brought her to this state. She had exalted reason over every other faculty. The result had been, was now, the deepest unhappiness she had ever felt. But we shouldn't believe things because it makes us happy to, she thought. We should believe things because they're true. And if that makes us unhappy, that's very unfortunate, but it's not the fault of reason. How do we see that things are true? They make sense. True things are more economical than false ones. Occam's razor. Things are more likely to be simple than complicated. If there is an explanation that leaves out things like imagination and emotion, then it's more likely to be true than one that includes them. But then she remembered what the Egyptians had said. Include things. Don't leave them out. Look at things in their context. Include everything. She felt a little spring of hope when she remembered that. She thought on. When I believed in the jack-o'-lanterns, I saw more of them. Was that delusional? Was I making them up or seeing them? Was it rational to lift the little red fruit to Will's lips in that little sunlit wood and relive the act they'd heard Mary Malone describe? The one that had made her fall in love? Had reason ever created a poem? Or a symphony? Or a painting? If rationality can't see things like the secret commonwealth, it's because rationality's vision is limited. The secret commonwealth is there. We can't see it with rationality any more than we can weigh something with a microscope. It's the wrong sort of instrument. We need to imagine as well as measure. But then she remembered what Pan had said about her imagination, and that cruel little note in the bedroom at the Trout. Pan had left in order to look for a quality she hadn't got. And dust? Where did that come in? Was it a metaphor? Was it part of the secret commonwealth? And the burning Dutchman? What would reason say about him? He couldn't exist. He was a delusion. She had dreamed it all. It hadn't happened. Before she could examine that question, the ferry hit something. Lyra felt the shock almost before she heard the bang and the rending sound of metal being torn. And then came a roar from the engines as the helmsman immediately signaled full astern. The ferry shuddered, lurching awkwardly like a horse refusing a jump. And as the propeller thrashed the water, Lyra heard something else. Human voices crying out in pain or panic. She threw off the blanket and ran to the rail. She could see very little from where she was, amidships, so she hurried forward, having to grab the rail as the boat plunged and shook. More people were coming out to see what was happening from the bar, from their cabins, or like her, from sleeping places on the deck. Voices rose all around, their meaning clear, whatever the language.
"What's the matter? Have we run aground? I can hear a baby! Someone put a spotlight on! Look! In the water!"
The momentum of the vessel was still greater than the power of the screw, and it hadn't yet come to a halt. And Lyra, looking down where the last speaker was pointing, saw planks, broken wood, a lifebelt, other unidentifiable detritus from a shattered boat, and people. Bodies in the water, heads, faces, arms, screaming, waving, sinking and struggling up again. They seemed to be floating past the ferry, but it was only the ferry still moving forward. Finally, the bite of the propeller in the water overcame the forward momentum and pulled the vessel to a halt. The sound of the engines fell at once. More voices now, shouting from the deck, from the bridge, men's voices in Anatolian, and deckhands came running to throw ropes over the side and lifebelts and to lower a boat that swung from its davit over the deck. The scene in the water was lit by a spotlight that was being hastily rigged on the foredeck, and by the light from every window or porthole on the port side. It became clear that the ferry had run down this smaller boat, which must have been showing no lights, and that the boat was carrying a large number of passengers, far more than its size would suggest it could, because the whole side of the boat had now drifted into view, lying dead in the water, with a dozen or more men and women clinging to it. A woman kept trying to push a baby up onto it, herself sinking below the water every time she tried, and the baby was screaming and struggling, and no one helped. Lyra couldn't stop herself crying out, "Help her! Help her!" Each of the men clinging to the overturned boat was in fear for their own lives, and had no strength left to help the woman. And after several attempts to get the baby safe, the woman herself sank under the surface, leaving the baby still struggling, its little voice choked with water. Lyra, like the other passengers watching, could only call out in horror and point. And finally one of the men let go, grabbed the baby by an arm, and flung it up onto the rocking planks before sinking himself and drifting away into the dark. By that time the deckhands had got the lifeboat down, and while two men plied the oars, another leaned over the stern and pulled the swimmers on board. Meanwhile others had rigged a gangplank from an opening in the side of the ferry, where light spilled out over the water, showing the wrecked boat, the swimmers still struggling, and some people who were drowned already, and who floated limp on the rocking water, face down. Lyra thought that if the ferry had cut the boat in two, there must be some people on the starboard side as well as on the port. She ran across the deck, which was now thronged with passengers trying to see what was happening, and found she was right. There were people in the water on that side, too. Not so many, but just as desperate. And no one had seen them. They had nothing but scraps of planking to hold on to, and they were calling for help, but no one could hear them. Lyra saw an officer running down the companionway from the bridge and seized his sleeve. "Look! More people this side! They need a lifeboat here, too!" He shook his head, unable to understand, but she pulled his arm and pointed down. He said something short and sharp, and wrenched her hand off his sleeve. His demon, a lemur of some kind, was chittering fearfully in his ear, staring and pointing at Lyra. The man looked at Lyra with revulsion, seeing no demon, and said something angry. "The boat!" she shouted. "Lower the boat on this side! They're drowning!" A deckhand heard her, looked over and saw where she was pointing, and spoke quickly to the officer, who gave a curt nod and moved away. The deckhand ran to the lifeboat, and began to make the davit ready to lower it. Another man joined him. Lyra ran inside, and darted down the steps two at a time, making for the gangway. She found a number of the rescued people already on board, huddling and shivering, and passengers and crew handing out blankets and helping those who were injured. She pushed through the crowd of those who had just come to stare, and went out onto the swaying gangway to help pull the remaining victims out. They were mostly young men, but there were women and children too, people of every age. They looked as if they had come from North Africa, or the Levantine countries. Their clothes were poor and thin, and although one or two clung to rucksacks or shopping bags, they had no other possessions at all. Perhaps their few things had gone down with the boat. The starboard lifeboat was on the water now, and more of the victims were being pulled to safety. Lyra helped to haul two young men and five children up onto the platform, and the last person to make it there was a very old woman, stiff with fear, being pulled along by a boy of 12 or so, who might have been her grandson. Lyra tugged him up first, and then between them they hauled the old woman aboard. She was shaking with cold. They were all cold. And Lyra, despite the exertion and her warm jacket, was soon shivering too. She peered out at the lapping water, scattered with wreckage and bits of clothing and unidentifiable objects that were once so important that people thought it worth carrying them away when they fled. Had they been fleeing from something? It looked like it. Lyra? She turned in alarm. It was Alison Weatherfield, warm and anxious. Lyra hadn't realized she was on the ferry.
"I think they've got everyone out on this side," Lyra said. "Come and help. These sailors don't know what to do once they've got them aboard."
Lyra followed her.
"Where do you think these people are from?" she said. "They look like refugees." "That's exactly what they are. They're probably farmers or rose gardeners fleeing from the mountain men."
Lyra thought of the people she'd seen disembarking from the river steamer in Prague. Had they, too, come from this part of the world? Was this happening all over Europe? But there was no time to think about that. In the saloon, they found 60, maybe 70 people all soaking wet, all freezing cold, the children crying, old people lying helpless, their demons feebly clinging to their sodden clothes. And more people limped or tottered in every minute as the last survivors were pulled out of the sea. And not only survivors. The sailors had picked up a number of bodies from the water, too, and the cries of their relatives as they recognized this child, that woman, made Lyra's heart turn over with sorrow. But Alison was everywhere, calling instructions to the crew, comforting a frightened mother, enfolding a baby in a blanket snatched from a passenger, calling for the ship's cook and demanding hot drinks, hot soup, bread and cheese for the survivors, some of whom seemed to be near to starvation. Lyra followed and helped carry out her instructions, giving out blankets, picking up a baby that seemed to belong to no one and was too frightened or too shocked even to cry, and rocking it on her breast. Little by little, the chaos crystallized into a sort of rough order. Alison was the source of that. She was abrupt, she was rude, she was impatient, but everything she said was clear, and every instruction made sense, and as well as giving the ferry passengers things to do that were obviously helpful, she radiated an air of certainty and experience. "You looking for dry clothes for that child?" she said, seeing Lyra nonplussed by her burden. "Well, yes. The woman over there in the green coat's got some. You'll have to change the child's nappy. Ever done that?" "No." "Well, it's common sense. Work it out. Get the child dry and clean and warm before you do anything else." Lyra was glad to obey, and made a creditable job of it, she thought. Once the child, who turned out to be a boy, was washed and wrapped up warmly, she supposed he would need feeding, and began to look for something he could eat, only to be stopped by a woman with wild eyes, still wearing the sodden clothes she'd been pulled out of the sea in, who pointed at the baby and herself, sobbing with relief. Lyra handed him over, and at once the woman put him to her breast, chilly and damp though that was, and a moment later the child was sucking passionately. Then Alison called her over to help with a different problem. A girl of 5 or 6 years old, all alone, warm and dry at least by now, and in the clothes of another and slightly bigger child, was seemingly mesmerized or frozen with horror. She could hardly move. Her mouse demon clutched at her neck, shivering. Her eyes were focused on the middle distance, no matter what was in front of her. "The family's all drowned," said Alison. "Her name's Aisha. She only speaks Arabic. She's in your charge now." And she turned away to deal with the sobbing little boy. Lyra nearly quailed, but the girl's frozen gaze and the terror in the eyes of her tiny demon decided her. She crouched down beside her and took her limp and frozen hand. "Aisha," she whispered. The demon crept down into the neck of the big sweater the girl was wearing, and Lyra thought, "Pan, you should be here. This demon needs you. You shouldn't have left me." "Aisha Ta'ali," she said, trying to recall the Arabic vocabulary the scholars at Jordan had drilled into her so many years before. "Ta'ali," she said again, hoping it meant come. She stood, holding on to the child's all but lifeless hand, and tugged gently. The girl didn't resist, didn't obey, just seemed to float with her, as if she had no bodily presence at all. Lyra was desperate to take her away from the crying, the noise of voices raised in sorrow or desperation, the sight of the rows of dead, partly covered by blankets or sheets, from all the confusion and distress. On the way out of the saloon, she picked up a round Turkish flatbread and a small carton of milk from the buffet. She led the child to the wicker chair she'd been half sleeping in when the ferry had run into the other boat. It was wide enough for them both, and the blanket was still there. She laid the bread and milk on the deck beside her, and wrapped herself and the child in the blanket. She scrupulously avoided touching the little demon, who trembled and whispered at the girl's neck, more alive, it seemed, than Aisha was herself. Lyra picked up the bread.
"Aisha?" "Koobs," she said. "Inti Ja'ana."
She broke off a piece and offered it. Aisha didn't seem to hear or see. Lyra nibbled it herself, hoping the child would see that it was harmless. But again, there was no response.
"Well, I'll just hold you, and the bread's here when you need it," she whispered. "I tell you in Arabic, but I didn't pay enough attention to my lessons when I was little. I know you're not understanding this, but you've had enough to deal with tonight, and I won't be giving you a test on it. I just hope I can make you warm."
The girl lay at Lyra's side, in her left arm, and a great coldness seemed to emanate from her frail body. Lyra tucked the blanket around her again, making sure she was covered.
"Well, you're really cold, Aisha, but it's a big blanket and you'll warm up soon. We'll warm each other up. You can go to sleep if you feel like it. Don't worry if you can't understand me. Of course, if you spoke to me, I wouldn't understand you either. We just have to wave our hands and pull faces and point. We'll probably understand in the end."
She nibbled another piece of the bread.
"Look, if you don't take some soon, I'll have eaten it all, and that'll look very fine, won't it? Me scoffing the food they brought for you and the other people from your boat. Be a scandal. I'd be in all the papers.
exposed as a thief and an exploiter of the dispossessed. There'd be a picture of me looking guilty and you looking reproachful. I'm sure this isn't helping. I just thought if I kept on whispering. I know. I'll sing you a song. From somewhere very deep and very far back, there came the words of one nursery rhyme after another. Little bits of nonsense with rhymes and tunes and rhythms that the baby Lyra had loved without understanding them at all. She'd been somewhere warm on a lap or in someone's arms, and the lulling words and the simple tunes were part of the warmth and the safety. She sang them very softly to the child, pretending that Aisha was Lyra, and Lyra was... Who could it have been? It must have been Alice. Sharp-tongued, caustic Alice, with the soft breast and the warm arms. After a few minutes, she found a little chilly presence at her neck. The child's demon was cuddling up against her, knowing no better, and it was all Lyra could do to keep her voice steady as she sang, because she herself had missed that feeling so much. So much. And presently, they all fell asleep together. And she dreamed of the cat again, the demon cat. She was entwining herself between Lyra's legs as they stood on that moonlit lawn, and the atmosphere of love and bliss was still there, but shot through now with anxiety. She had to do something. She had to go somewhere. The cat was urging her to follow, taking a few steps away, turning to look back at her, coming back and then going away again. And now, she wasn't sure she was Will's demon after all. The moonlight bleached out all the colours. This was a black and white world. She tried to follow the cat, but her legs wouldn't move. At the edge of the trees, the demon looked back once more, and then moved away and into the darkness. Lyra was overwhelmed with love and loss and sorrow, and tears ran down her sleeping cheeks. They woke to a bright morning. The sun hadn't yet appeared over the mountains, but the air was clear and clean, and the sea was as still as glass. The steady, quiet beat of the engines was the only sound, until Lyra heard the calls of seabirds, too, and human voices nearby.
"Aisha," she whispered. "Are you awake? Saya."
She felt a frightened little scamper. The girl's demon had been sleeping between the two of them, and woken to find the presence of this stranger alarming. He darted back to Aisha's breast, and the girl sensed his fear and felt it too, and she drew away with a little whimper of anxiety. Lyra sat up gently and tucked the blanket around the child. It was sharply cold without it. Aisha watched her every movement, as if Lyra would murder her unless she kept guard.
"Aisha, don't be scared of me," Lyra said quietly. "We've been asleep, and it's morning. Here, look. Eat a bit of this bread. It's pretty stale, but it's all right."
She gave the child the rest of the flatbread. Aisha took it and nibbled the edge, not daring to take her eyes off Lyra, who smiled at her. There was no smile in response, but Lyra was glad to see her unfrozen from that mesmerized horror of the night.
"There's some milk, too," she said.
She twisted the top of the carton and tore off the tab. Aisha took it and drank, handing it back to Lyra when she'd had enough. That little reaction itself was encouraging. Lyra held it for her, while Aisha ate a little more bread. She thought, sometime soon she's going to remember what happened and realize that she's lost everyone. And then what? Her mind moved over different possibilities. Aisha in the company of others like her, moving laboriously westwards in the hope of refuge, hungry, cold, robbed of the little she had, or being taken in by a family who didn't speak her language, who treated her as a slave, who beat her and starved her, who sold her to men who would use her little body in any way they liked, or being turned away from house after house, begging for shelter on a winter night. But people were better than that, surely.
Wasn't the human race better than that? She wrapped the blanket more carefully around the little girl and held her close, turning her head away so her tears wouldn't run down onto Aisha's face. Slowly, around them the ship was coming awake. Other people had been sleeping on the deck, wrapped up in blankets or huddling close together, and now they were beginning to stir, talking in quiet tones or sitting up stiffly. Aisha said something. Lyra could hardly hear her, and couldn't understand anyway, but something in the way the child was moving made it clear what she meant. And Lyra stood up and helped her up too, draping the blanket around her to keep in the warmth, and led her to a lavatory. She waited outside, still half asleep, and listened to the voices around, in the hope of hearing a word or two that she understood. Little shreds and snatches, splinters of meaning like flying fishes appearing for a moment above the water and then disappearing again. That was all. Then the note of the engine slowed, and the slight movement changed as the boat seemed to be turning tightly. Not again, thought Lyra, but a few moments later it began to pitch a little and lean into the turn. In the confined and overheated passageway with no sight of the sea, Lyra began to feel a little queasy, and when Aisha came out, she took the child's hand and led her out on deck again where the air was fresh. Aisha held her hand readily enough, and her demon seemed more active and less fearful than he'd been in the night. He was whispering in the girl's ear and watching Lyra all the time. Aisha murmured a word or two in response. Lyra saw a queue of people forming on the deck outside the main saloon and led Aisha to join it, hoping it was for breakfast. And so it turned out to be. Fresh flatbreads and a little cheese. Lyra took some and went back to the chair, where Aisha sat huddled up under the blanket, bread in one hand and cheese in the other, and nibbled steadily. Then Lyra noticed that the ferry had indeed changed direction, and was now slowing down and moving towards a harbour under the rocky hills of an island. "I wonder where this is," she said to Aisha. The child simply stared at her, and then at the hills, the little town of white-painted houses, the fishing boats in the harbour. "Well, how's she doing?" said Alison Weatherfield, appearing suddenly beside them. "She's eating, at least," said Lyra. "What about you? Have you eaten something?" "I thought the food was for the refugees." "Well, go and buy something from the cafeteria. I'll wait here. You won't be any use if you're hungry." Lyra did, and came back with bread and cheese for herself and a spice cake for the child. The only drink available was a sweet mint tea, which was hot at least. Every part of the vessel was crowded and noisy, and alive with voices expressing fear, curiosity, anger, and sorrow. And Lyra was grateful for it, because she was definitely less interesting than the situation they were all in, and she could pass among people without being noticed at all. When she got back to the child, she found her talking freely to Alison. Freely, but quietly, and with eyes lowered, and in a monotone. Lyra tried to follow her words, but could make out very little. Perhaps Aisha spoke a dialect of Arabic different from the classical kind they taught at Jordan College. Or perhaps Lyra simply hadn't paid attention to her lessons. She offered the spice cake, and the child looked up just once as she accepted it, and then cast her eyes down again. And Lyra knew in a moment that the trust of the night was gone, and Aisha now felt the fear every human being felt for someone so mutilated as to be without a demon. "I'm going to wash," she said to Alison, not noticing that the woman had seen Aisha's fear and the immediate sadness it had caused Lyra. When she came back, hoping she looked refreshed, she said, "Where are we? What's this place?" "One of the Greek islands. I don't know which one. The refugees will go ashore here, no doubt. I don't expect the Greeks will refuse to let them land. They'll take them to the mainland eventually, and they'll settle somewhere." "What will happen to her?" "I've spoken to a woman who'll look after her. We can only do so much, Lyra. There comes a point when we have to accept that other people can do more." Aisha was now finishing the spice cake, her eyes still firmly cast down. Lyra wanted to stroke her hair, but held back, not wanting to frighten her. The ferry had come to rest against a quay, and deckhands were making it fast to bollards at the bow and the stern. There was a loud clatter of chains as a gangway was lowered, and a little crowd was already gathering on the waterfront to see what had brought the ferry to their harbour. Lyra stood at the rail and watched the activity unfold, and gradually fell into a kind of trance. Perhaps she hadn't slept well, or perhaps her energy was depleted, but she found herself withdrawing, little by little, into a labyrinth of daydream and speculation, all involving demons. The moment in the night when the little mouse demon had cuddled against her, had that really happened? She was as sure of it as she could be of anything, but, as so often now, it was the meaning that was a mystery. Perhaps there was no meaning. That's what Simon Talbot would say. She felt a lurch of revulsion, and then she thought something else. She'd felt at the time that the poor little demon was attracted by her warmth, the greater certainty of her adulthood, by the simple fact of her being in charge and offering comfort. Now it occurred to her that there was another interpretation. Perhaps it was the little demon himself who sensed a loneliness and desolation in Lyra, and came to give her comfort, not the other way round at all. And it had worked. That thought was a shock, but it convinced her. She wanted to express her gratitude, but when she turned to look at the child again, she found that it would be impossible. There was no point where they could meet and understand each other. The moment in the night was an end point, not a starting point. "Can I do anything to help?" she said to Alison when the woman got up and lifted the child to her feet. "I've decided I should go ashore to see that they're looked after properly. I've got no authority. All I can do is boss people. But it seems to work. I'll wait for a later boat. I doubt whether the captain will want to lose more time than he needs to. You stay on board and gather yourself, and go on and find your demon. That's what you need to do. If you go through Aleppo, don't leave without seeing Father Joseph at the English school. He's not hard to find, and he's a very good man. Goodbye, my dear." A brisk kiss, and she led Aisha away. The child didn't look back. The demon was a little bird now, of a kind that Lyra didn't recognize, and he'd probably already forgotten what he'd done in the night, though Lyra knew that she never would. She sat down in the wicker chair. In the warmth of the Aegean morning, she soon fell asleep. Chapter 24 The Bazaar. Malcolm and Mirzad Karimov spent the night in their dry cave, and woke to a warm, sunny morning. By staying in the forest, they managed to cross the border without being discovered. They could see from their path among the trees higher up the mountain the long queues of traffic that had built up on either side of the frontier post, and exchanged a silent glance of relief. From that point on, the journey was untroubled. Malcolm paid for Karimov's ticket as far as Constantinople, and they arrived 2 days after the assassination of the patriarch. They found the city in a state of feverish anxiety. Their travel documents were examined 3 times before they could manage to leave the railway station, and Malcolm's cover identity as a scholar travelling to study various documents in the libraries of that city was thoroughly ransacked. It stood up, because it was genuine, and the details of his contacts and sponsors and hosts had all been rigorously checked before he left London. But the manner of the soldiers who examined it was hostile and suspicious. He said goodbye to Karimov, whom he'd come to like a great deal. He had told Malcolm everything he knew about Tashbalak and the work of the scientists there, and about the desert of Karamakan, and about the poem Jahan and Roxana, long passages of which Karimov knew by heart. He was going to pick up some business in Constantinople, he said, and join a caravan further along on the Silk Road.
"Malcolm, thank you for your companionship on this journey," he said as they shook hands outside the railway station. "May God keep you safe."
"I hope you'll do the same for you, my friend," said Malcolm. "Go well." After finding a cheap hotel, he set out to call on an old acquaintance of his, an inspector in the Turkish police who was an unofficial friend of Oakley Street. But on his way to the police headquarters, he realized that he was being followed. It wasn't hard to see in shop windows and the glass doors of banks and office buildings the young man who was on his trail. The only way of following someone with real success without being detected was to have a team of 3 people doing it, all trained and experienced. But this young man was on his own and had to stay close. Without looking at him directly, Malcolm had plenty of time to examine him. His dark good looks, his slender build, and his nervous sudden movements and pauses were clearly visible in the wealth of reflections Malcolm saw around him. He didn't look Turkish. He might have been Italian. In fact, he might have been English. He was wearing a green shirt, dark trousers, and a pale linen jacket. His demon was a small hawk. His face was badly bruised, and there was a plaster across the bridge of his nose. Malcolm moved gradually towards the more crowded streets, where his follower would need to come nearer. He wondered whether the young man was familiar with the city. At a guess, he thought not. They were in the neighborhood of the Grand Bazaar, and Malcolm meant to lead him into the crowded alleys of the bazaar itself, where he'd have to come even closer. He came to the